This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. And as you can probably already tell, if you've listened to many of these podcasts, this one sounds different, and there's a reason for that. We're going to try something new today, and we're going to try something new because, frankly, I just forgot my equipment at home. Several years ago, since I've been doing this podcast for several years, I bought a fairly nice audio recorder. Records in stereo. It's very beautiful. It has automatic voice limiting built into it. It is very, very cool. And it records really nicely. I left that at home today. So I was going to have breakfast with a friend this morning and lost my connection with him somewhere. He didn't show up. Sometimes people oversleep. That just happens. I might have missed an email from him, though. So I wasn't going to call him and say, "Hey, buddy, where were you?" until I get back and check my email and see if he sent me an email late that said, "I'm not going to make it." But anyway, so fine. It's no problem. So I was sitting at the restaurant realizing suddenly that I did not have my audio recorder with me. And I was like, And so then I thought, well, I can just bring the audio recorder in and I can just record tomorrow because I'm probably coming in to have breakfast with a friend, even though I'm not going to work. You know, it'll be fine. And then I was thinking, wait a minute. I have a phone. Maybe my phone could just record this. So I downloaded a little app to do it. Actually bought an app to do it. It does seem to be a nice little app. The audio quality is not nearly as good as my recorder, of course, because the recorder cost a non-trivial amount of money. Let's put it that way. It cost a non-trivial amount of money. I am doing this. I do have a little errand that I need to run on the way home. And since I'm doing this with my phone, I'm thinking I could run the errand to where we could do something that I have never done on the podcast before. I have to run in and get some milk for my wife. So I'm thinking that maybe I'll just stop and I'll just pick up my phone and act like I'm talking on the phone, and then I can keep doing the podcast. It will be the stealth podcast is what that will be. Anyways, it's been a good week. Got a lot of good things accomplished at work. Had a bunch of projects that were all supposed to be done around the November 1st timeline, and landed one of them today. Handed off the second one for final testing, which I did not set that deadline on that one, but we're really close. And then we are really, really close on the third one as well. So I think we're in good shape there. As far as writing goes, I did upload all the files for the second novel in the Grumpy Old Prophet series over the weekend. And so I have the first two ready for production now. And I'm working on the third one now, just getting all my corrections in, getting that going. So I think I'm in pretty good shape to have these all wrapped up by sometime around December 1st. Covers, you know, everything ready to go, all the edits in. So that'll be good. Because then I'm planning on ordering some sets just for myself to give out for Christmas. And then I will get started on the next series. So that's, well, obviously, let's see, what else? Halloween. Fall Festival, whatever you want to call it. We went to the church praise assembly where my son is the youth pastor / associate pastor, and so they had Clara there dressed up in, as a little sock monkey, and so that was cute. So we went and saw that for a little while. What else? I've had some really nice conversations with friends this week about the topic that we're going to talk about today. And I have enough to talk about on that. We can probably just go get started. I'm trying to think how much time it's going to take me to actually go into the Walmart and get some milk and come out. And there may be some points in this where I will be talking to other people. So sorry for that interruption. I'm sure it won't be, you know, the most exciting thing just to hear me talking to other people, but who knows? We may be starting a new form of entertainment here today for the first time on the podcast. Anyways, topic for today was a follow-up on something that I mentioned several weeks ago and said I was going to buy the book. The book has now come out. I did buy the book, and I have read the book. In fact, I've read portions of the book twice. Several weeks ago, I had mentioned a Newsweek article that I had read about a neurosurgeon. About a neurosurgeon who had an afterlife experience or a near-death experience, whatever we want to call them. And what is somewhat interesting about his situation is not only was he a neurosurgeon, and so very, very well-versed, obviously, in the mechanisms of the mind, he was also, his experience was fundamentally different than others. And after I relate his experience a little bit, you will understand more about why his experience is fundamentally different. So, you got this guy, his name's Eben, I can't remember his last name, but he's a neurosurgeon, his dad before him is a neurosurgeon, his eldest son is studying to be a neurosurgeon. This is a family that is steeped in medical culture. It seems to be a fairly ordinary day. He gets up in the morning. I think he had been having some kind of flu-like symptoms for a couple of days, but he just figured he was trying to stay ahead of something, so he really didn't pay much attention to that. Develops a backache, really severe backache, decides he's going to, I think, take a bath to kind of help it. And so he does that, and he realizes he may not even be able to get out of the bathtub. It's hurting so bad. I think he manages to hobble out of the bathtub, but he mentions it to his wife that he's, you know, his back is really, really hurting. And so he says he's going to lie down, and she says, well, should we call 911? And he says, no, I'm fine. It's just, I've just got a backache. I'll be fine. Because he said doctors do not like to be taken to the hospital, and they certainly don't like, as patients, and they certainly don't like to be taken there in ambulances. So he says, you know, no, I'm fine. Okay, so she goes down, I think, and does some work and things, comes up to check on him, short time later, an hour later, whatever. And by this time, he is having a grand mal seizure. So she, obviously, this is not something that she is interested in seeing. And so she immediately calls 911. They get the ambulance there and pick him up. By the time they get him to the hospital, I'm parking in Walmart parking lot at the moment. This is going to be interesting to see how this goes, because obviously I have never done this before. And normally when I'm walking through Walmart, I greet people and say hello to people. And now I'm just going to be talking on the phone. This is going to be weird. We're going to try it. Okay, I'm grabbing my phone. So anyway,
check, testing, 1, 2, mic, check. Oh, let's put this up here. Mic, wait, check, testing, wait. 1, 2, mic, check, test,
oh,
one,
wait,
two.
No. Well, that was very exciting.
I hit the wrong button and I played back my mic check. Okay, great. Anyways, so I'm really hoping that... Oh, the gain's all the way down. I'm really hoping that I don't just blow out the speaker on here, so I may just talk a little softer. Anyways, so... He gets in the ambulance. They take him to the hospital. They take him to the hospital where he works. And when, by the time he gets there, he is thrashing because he is in so much pain. And the emergency room doctor who works on him doesn't even recognize him at first because he's in so much pain. And then once she recognizes him, you know, she looks at the staff and she goes, "This is Eben." And, you know, they're all kind of stunned a little bit. Anyway, so they actually have to hold him down. Three orderlies have to hold him down. It's really, you know, really a dramatic, dramatic thing. At one point, after they eliminate all the obvious stuff, she decides that she's going to do a spinal tap on him to see if there's a problem with his spinal fluid. And so... again, takes three orderlies to hold him down, turn him over, get him in a fetal position. And they go ahead and they do the tap. And normally, with a spinal tap, the spinal fluid, I guess, comes dripping out. And it's supposed to be clear. So they said when they did the tap on him, it actually spurted out because... his spinal fluid was under so much pressure and it was green and filled with pus. So this is like, this is a bad deal. And immediately they knew that this was extremely serious. And so I just picked up the milk. That's what that noise was. So they knew this was extremely serious. And so they put him on triple antibiotics immediately, intravenously, to try to knock this down. And then we're trying to figure out, okay, what kind of infection has actually gotten in there. And the infection that had gotten in was actually an E. coli strain. It's very rare. Usually the only time they see this type of infection in the brain is when someone has had brain surgery, because the brain is really good about keeping these types of infections out because they are really, really bad on the brain. In fact, they eat away at the brain. So they've got him on triple antibiotics, and they come to the sinking realization fairly quickly that the antibiotics really aren't making that much progress with it. So now they're thinking, okay, now we're dealing with a strain that is bacterial, that is resistant, and they're trying to figure out, okay, so we've got a antibacteria resistant strain in his brain that's eating away. Not good. It's just really, really not good. So he said at one point that he was thrashing around. They had him in ICU. They were trying to keep him sedated, trying to keep the intravenous drugs into his system to try to fight the infection. And the entire time, he's been thrashing around, making like animal noises because he's in so much pain. And he said, suddenly, he got quiet and he shouted out three words, "God help me." And then at that point, he lapsed and he went into a coma. And he is in the coma then for 7 days before it's all said and done. And the entire time he's in this coma, this E. coli bacteria is eating away at his brain. So this is a very dramatic story. Anyways, I'm about ready to get checked out here, and I'm going to have to pause while we do this. Well, not quite yet. Not quite yet. But anyway, so he's in this coma. And he said, typically, when people have these type of infections, and it only happens in 1 in 10 million people, but he said, typically, when people get these types of infections, if you don't get them out of the coma within a day, their chances really, really start going downhill. Okay, just a second. I will be back. You'll hear sounds in the background.
How are you today? Good, good. Big spender today. No cash back.
All right. Thank you. Have a nice day. Okay, so typically they said, he said, if you don't get the person out of there in a day, that's bad. If it goes for 2 to 3 days, pretty much it's over, you know, because even if you can get the person back out, they're just going to be a vegetable the rest of their life because the bacteria is just chewing away at their brain. Okay, so that's not such a good deal. This guy was in a coma for 7 days with this. And in fact, when he had gotten to the 7 day point and hadn't made much progress, you know, they hadn't seen him come back out of it, they actually sat down with his wife and they started having the serious conversation with the wife and saying, look, you know, even if we're able to get him back out of this coma, by this point, there's really not much left. And you should really consider just taking him off all the antibiotics, going ahead and letting the bacteria do its job that it's trying to do, and let him go. Okay, I am back in my car. I am back in my car now, okay. That was a little weird. I'd never tried that before. Okay, so I'm going home now. So, I don't know if this is going to be worth listening to. I'll have to listen to it when I get home and then I'll see. So anyways, the interesting part then comes. I'm backing up out of the parking space. And then we'll start heading home. And my phone is also making little sounds about, you know, that probably is reminding me that I need to record the podcast or something. So, anyways, so they pull his wife in and they say, look, it's been 7 days. You know, the people just can't survive this. And they say, it's time. You have to make the decision. So while she's trying to make this decision, she has brought her boy with her, because the man has an older son and then a 10-year-old son, brought her boy with her. She didn't want the boy to hear the prognosis, so she asked the boy to sit outside the room. He's listening at the door, hears enough that he understands what they're talking about, and he goes running down the hall down to where his dad is. You know, and he pries his dad's eyes open and starts saying, Dad, you got to come back. You got to come back now. Dad, you got to come back. And what's interesting is the neurosurgeon was saying, man who had this experience, he was saying that coma patients' families often do this. They often pry open the eyes of the coma victims to say, come on, wake up, wake up. But it can be very disconcerting because the muscles aren't working when a person is in coma typically. And so one eyeball can be going one way and one eyeball can be going another. And so the son is saying, come on, come on, come on, Dad, wake up. And at the same time, a family friend who is with the wife hearing all these news, she just gets this feeling and she says, okay, just a second. She said, just wait before we do any more. And so she goes to the room to kind of see Eben one more time. And
you know, she starts like patting his arm and rubbing his arm and saying, you need to come back, even, you need to come back. And she said, and then his eyes just popped open. They just popped open. And so, of course, the lady starts screaming and running for the doctor, saying, he's coming back, he's coming back. And by the time they got in there, he was seated up in bed. And when they walked in, he was, you know, smiling and saying, all is well, all is well. Now, we'll get to his recovery more in a minute, because his recovery is very interesting, and it's quite an interesting process. But this is what makes this experience somewhat unique from a near-death experience standpoint. The guy should be dead. Really, really should be dead. He reports later in the book that when doctors encountered him after he came back, they would just shake their head. Because they've got all the brain scans. He had no upper brain function for 7 days. Just wasn't there while this bacteria ate his brain. So that's pretty interesting. As he's coming back, it's pretty interesting too, because in his way of describing it, he felt like what had happened was that his spirit, his consciousness, this eternal, multi-dimensional, you know, being that could understand much more than he could understand as a linear human, was trying to get shoehorned back into his linear brain. And he described a process called ICU psychosis. And he said they see this in people whose brains are rebooting. He said he would be sitting there and he would be in the moment, you know, sort of remembering that he had just woken up from a coma, and then suddenly he'd be skydiving. He'd have a memory, and all these memories were just popping around in his brain, and he'd go back and forth between all these things. And he said it was a bit disconcerting for his family, and especially his 10-year-old boy, because his 10-year-old boy was thinking, oh, my dad's back now, everything's fine. And he said it was difficult for him to carry on a lucid conversation because he would suddenly be someplace else, remembering it was someplace else. But day after day, it just kept getting better. He said at one point he had volunteered to his son that he would help his son with a project. And it was in neuroscience, and he got dismayed very quickly because he couldn't remember the terminology. And then he said a couple of days later, he said just bam, he wakes up one day and he's got pieces of the medical terminology back, and the next day he's got more, and it just all comes back. And from what he says, he has made a full recovery. So that's pretty amazing. And again, as I said before, he has recovered from something that should be medically impossible to recover from. And yet he's alive and well. Okay, so that's from the physical side of it. Now then, of course, the big thing is, well, what about the spiritual side of it? And what about heaven? Because that's what we're all interested in. We want to know about heaven. His was a very interesting near-death experience. And when he returned, one of the things he told his eldest son that he wanted to do was to review all of the material on near-death experiences and just see how his near-death experience corresponded to those things. And his son very wisely told him, Dad, don't do that. Or don't do that yet. Just go ahead and write down everything that you can remember, and then study it and see how it lines up. Okay, well, so some of the things that he was talking about, they sound familiar with other near-death experiences, and then others don't. That's very interesting. He talked about starting in a place that he came to call, I think it was the Earthworm, Earthworm's Eye View. It was kind of a dark, murky place. It was like dark jello. You could sort of see through it. And then, and when he became aware of that, he had no recollection of his life on Earth. He was completely disconnected from his life on Earth, which is interesting. That's not usual for a near-death experience. And then eventually he came to realize that he wasn't supposed to just be there. And so, and he says, as soon as he wanted to be someplace else, this light came to him.
Excuse me.
I am yawning a lot today. And opened up a passageway, and then he flew out the passageway, and there was a guide there, a woman that took him around, and he saw more of the standard heaven stuff. You know, he saw the people playing, and everything was vibrant, and everything was very, very real. And then he said he also went into what he called the core, and he came to understand that this was God. And he described the core with a quote from a poet that talked about God as being a deep and dazzling darkness. And this, it does parallel what some of the Christian mystics have said about God. As they meditate and as they get deeper into meditation, they experience the cloud of unknowing, they call it, the cloud of unknowing. And that they're in this darkness and they keep sinking deeper into it, and then there is this brilliant light. And so it's interesting. So he basically had experience in these three realms, this kind of earthworm view, as he called it, and then the gateway that he called it, where everybody was, and then the core that was God. And he said he, in that place, whenever he would think of a question, the answer would just come instantaneously. And he learned many, many things while he was there. He said that one of the things that he learned was that our universe is not the only universe, that there are multiple universes, and some of them are inhabited by beings who are much more intelligent than we are. Okay, well, that's fine. And that what he absolutely knew that he had learned was what I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that he had learned that if he could boil it down into three things, it was, you are deeply loved and cherished. You have nothing to be afraid of, and you can never do anything wrong. And that last one, you can never do anything wrong, was the one that the wife of the couple that I go out with on Saturday morning, she looked at me and she said, that last one, I think I'm going to need a little more explanation on that, which is the reason I bought the book. I wanted to see if there was more explanation on it. And the short answer is no, there was no further explanation on it. In fact, when it comes down to the things that Eben thinks that he learned while he was in heaven, that's basically all he says, aside from the fact that there's multiple universes, but it's that you are loved and cherished, you don't have anything to be afraid of, and you can never do anything wrong. And he just puts it out there. Okay, well, that's okay, interesting. And I think for my own personal life, I have really changed in my life as I've gotten older. I've really changed how I evaluate things. Growing up and in my early adulthood, while I hope that I have never been a very condemning person. I was in my early adulthood very much aware of the lines of demarcation. And it's something I think we're trained to do. So we are trained to dismiss information that isn't coming from a source that meets our criteria. So for fundamentalist Christians, it's, well, if you aren't a Christian and you don't hit certain buzzwords in your conversation with me, like if you didn't go to heaven and see Jesus, or if when you come back you don't talk about how Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and the only way to get to heaven, then we're not going to listen to anything you have to say. And I've really adopted a different approach in the last decade, in the last 15 years or so. Because I remember a day when there would have been certain performers, certain talk show hosts, for instance, like Oprah, that because she was exploring a lot of new age techniques and things, I would have thought, oh, well, forget it then. She's off the rails, so I'm not ever going to listen to her again. And, ooh, you know, I'm not going to follow her because she's going to lead me astray. And instead of taking that approach, where it's a fairly rigid approach that you have to do it my way, or I'm not going to entertain what you're saying, I've really adopted an approach of that it's fairly easy to listen and to figure out what the good stuff is and keep that. And it really comes down to a discernment of what is flesh and what is spirit. And frankly, it comes down to a discernment of what is love and what is not love. And so if there is an expression of love, I tend at this point in my life to say, okay, expression of love, ta-ta, sounds like Jesus to me. It's really kind of that simple. And I know that some people will say, well, but, you know, you have to understand that Satan can deceive people. And so he might just be deceiving people. I am getting my mail, and I know for sure there is something in the lower part of my mailbox that I'm going to need to get. So I'm going to open my door here for a minute and get that. Whoops. Let's see. That's my proofs, and I have to mail this. Let's see, Smithco, mail copy 2. Good, good, good. Test authorizations. Okay. Yep. Okay. Got more mail. Good. All right. Now then, you know, because in the old days, I would have very much come at it from the viewpoint of, well, Satan is an angel of light, and he can deceive people, and so he might just be saying, well, you need to love one another just because he's trying to deceive people, and then he's going to take him down. So you got to make sure from the beginning that people have all their I's dotted and their T's crossed, and they've got everything together, and you got to make sure that they have these things that they say, because if they don't say those things, they're not a believer, and so we can't listen to them. And I have completely changed from all of that. And I am much less concerned that people have all their terminology in a row. I'm backing into my garage. I'm much less concerned that people have all their terminology in a row now than I am that they are encouraging people to take at least a step toward the spirit as opposed to the flesh. Because frankly, I've been around enough people that have all their terminology in place that are still some of the most curmudgeonly and some of the most antagonistic and bitter people that really are encouraging bitterness and antagonism in others who claim to be Christians and have all the right terminology. I've had enough experience with those that I'm really more interested in seeing someone manifest love and seeing them. You know, I just noticed that my light is flashing. I'm hoping this is still recording. Oh, it is. Okay, great. Wow, I'm already up at 35 minutes. Okay, I'm just going to put this back here for a minute. I'm more interested in seeing them encourage people to make a step forward into the Spirit. So I say all that to say that this man's experience, Dr. Eben's experience, is certainly a unique and interesting experience. And he certainly has a unique perspective on things. And he certainly has two out of the three things that he thinks he learned in heaven that I would absolutely, uncategorically agree with. Absolutely, that you are loved and cherished deeply forever and always, and that you have nothing to fear. I would absolutely agree with those two. And that theme has been a theme that has been resonating in my heart and my spirit as I've been writing these Grumpy Old Prophet books. So I am 100% behind those. As for the third one, you can never do anything wrong. About the only thing I have to say is, well, you know, Paul did say in 2 Corinthians 5:19 that God in Christ was reconciling the world to himself, and he no longer counts men's sins or no longer counts people's trespasses against them. He did say that. Now, how that translates to us as humans struggling with our flesh, trying to keep control of our flesh, and then being told, well, you can't ever do anything wrong. And the flesh saying, well, if you can't ever do anything wrong, you should just go out and have fun. You know, how that all translates, I don't know. But it's certainly an interesting experience that this man has had. And from the way he talks in the book, it seems like he is on a quest to try to unpack all the things that he has learned. He mentioned it enough that I got the impression from the book that there were a lot of other things that he had learned, and he couldn't quite get his arms around them now that he was back in his human body, but that he's hoping that over time, as he meditates and as he dwells on God, that those things will open back up for him. And that will be very, very interesting. Anyway, sorry for the weirdness of this format. It looks like I've been going 38 minutes, which is a really long time, but I did buy some milk, so sorry. Sorry that this was so long. This is Phil Ferret, and I have made it home.